has intentions of going to Mars. They do. And, you know, they have plenty of things on the drawing board on how they're going to go about doing it. Are they ready for it now? The first couple of missions, you're going to see an asteroid. They're going to go out to an asteroid, bring a piece back. You might see them orbit Mars. It's going to be a long time. It's going to be a long time before they actually come up with something to land on Mars. It's their goal. Can they do it with the SLS that they're building, the space launch system? Yes, they can. They're going to need habitat modules to attach to the Orion spacecraft. You're not going to be able to, and they have them designed. I've seen them. And, that's going to be your living quarters. You're not going to be living in a little capsule on the way there. This is going to be many billions of dollars, not a couple of billion dollars like this guy Bass wants to do. You're looking at, maybe $100 billion. Back to you, Nick.
Steve, easy. Okay, right now we've got, how's the second person lined up? Who was the first person? Can't remember who you were. Go ahead, you know who you are. Go ahead.
You never remember me, Dick. No matter how many times I check in, you'll never remember me. Here's a question for you. And this can go to Paul also. Has anybody working on any way of propelling this group of human beings faster so you get from point A to point B faster so it won't take you? Has anybody working on any kind of technology or looking into that at all? Because it seemed like we've done the same thing for 40 or 50 years and nothing's changed as far as how fast you can propel people through space.
From my understanding, not a chance, Joe. We're already using the most energetic fuels for rocket fuels that we can come up with. The only way you get higher efficiency out of a rocket is an ionic engine. The ionic engine gives you a hell of a lot of efficiency, but flea power and thrust, it takes a long time for it to build up any particular velocity. It's going to take you a year one way to Mars, no matter what the hell you do. And the actual trip you're going to take is 300 and some odd million miles. Yeah, that's the closest approach between Mars and Earth when they're in opposition. There's only 35 million miles between them. You can't launch that way. That's not a minimum energy orbit. That would take 10 times as much fuel. You ain't got it. So is there a way that you're going to get there faster with higher rocket fuel power? I doubt it. But maybe Hal knows a way. K60PZ, how would you solve this problem, Hal? K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW in TechNet, K60PZ. Well, the only thing I can think about is teleportation. If they come up with methods during teleportation, then they'll be able to get there pretty fast, Dick. Go ahead.
Makes great science fiction. If you watch that sci-fi movie called The Fly, or you watch any of the Star Treks when they beam down, let's go slow with that one. 10 to the 13 molecules, no, 10 to the 13 cells is a human being, and around 10 to the 13 molecules is a cell of a human being. With very complicated DNA in every one of those 10 to the 13 cells. Can you imagine the degree of difficulty of breaking that all down, shipping it as an electronic signal, and reassembling it in the exact right order, in the exact right placement, in any reasonable length of time? I mean, that's what a human being is. Can you imagine doing that? Great science fiction, but it's way out there. I mean, it's more fanciful than me flying by flapping my wings. I mean, I could decide that I'm going to flap my hands real fast and I'm going to fly. And by jumping off the chair each day and building up my muscles, I can show you that I'm making progress. Do you really think sometime downrange I'm going to get my arms strong enough and flap my hands fast enough that I'm going to fly? I mean, you study birds, Hal. Do you think I could possibly do that? K2RIW.
Well, wasn't there a bicycle-powered aircraft that, somebody was pedaling a bike and they were able to fly this aircraft? So anything is possible, Dick.
Yes. With the Gossamer Condor, a very specifically designed graphite-reinforced aircraft with a 120-foot wingspan, and with Brian Allen as a pilot. I mean, that is an extremely skilled sailplane pilot, 120-pound human being. I can turn out a third of a horsepower on an ergometer for a good fraction of an hour. You put together that pilot, that high-tech aircraft, yes, it now can do man-powered flight. Man is probably the very last animal in the chain of development of what's the word I'm looking for now? Evolution on the Earth that basically has the horsepower capability, even with an extremely efficient airplane. And you can only fly that on a windless day. Is that real flight is a very interesting question. It's just barely doing it. Now, man doesn't fly. With his own muscle power, with his own wings, not a chance. And so, to break someone down and teleport them, not a chance. No. Not even a thousand years can we do that. I mean, Alan, as a physician, has got a gut feel for how complicated are the number of cells, the assembly of those cells, for all of those organs, for all of those molecules, of all of those cells, and all of that DNA. Alan, give me your gut feel. Is there going to be teleportation in any reasonable length of time? KC2RFN, Dr. Alan Scott at K2RAW.
Of course not. I mean, it's never going to happen. I don't think it'll ever happen because eventually what you're really doing is making a copy. You know, if you look at the transporters in Star Trek, they're just making copies of the original. The original's being thrown away. So you're really not seeing the same Kirk or Spock. And by the way, Spock isn't dead. I'm sure they're going to find a way for Leonard Nimoy to come back.
Did you hear what the last 30 years of Leonard Nimoy's life was like? Did you read that story, Alan?
No.
During the time he was Spock, during the making of the television series called Star Trek, he was smoking 3 packs a day for that whole period of time. Within a couple of years of the Star Trek series ending in production, he gave up cigarette smoking. Part of the reason he gave up cigarette smoking, he's developed a very strong case of COPD. He kept that secret for the next 30 years, but it kept getting worse and worse, and it eventually was the thing that killed him. So, pulmonary obstructive disease, he had very little lung tissue left, and he was trying to live with it. In the last 30 years of his life, what's really sad is that he gave up cigarette smoking at a time that he was relatively healthy, per se. And you would like to believe that all of the damage ceases at that time. For whatever reason, that his particular genetics or something, the damage continued to occur even though he was no longer a smoker. KC2RFN, K2RAW.
And that does tie in very well with the discussion you had a couple of weeks ago about the smoking actually leaving cumulative amounts of radiation in the alveoli and its inability to protect itself. And over time, that would explain the consequences of smoking and the variability of the consequences.
Yeah, there's a series of 100 YouTube videos that are extremely well done science stories, science education. Done. It's the series is called Veritasium, V-E-R-I-T-A-S-I-U-M. You Google that word and you Google the radiation testing. Derek Muller did, this man from Australia, a very good scientist, he took his Geiger counter and went to all the best places in the world that have high radiation, which included Fukushima, Nagasaki, the Trinity site for the United States, Chernobyl, 3 Mile Island. He went to all these places with his Geiger counter and made measurements. Also went up in an airplane at 10,000, 20,000, and 30,000 feet, made measurements, and speculated from those measurements what the astronauts and the cosmonauts are being exposed to. And the worst place he could find, the worst place he could find was the basement of the hospital in Chernobyl, where the volunteers who tried to fix that situation in the beginning, and almost all of them died. The suits that they were wearing were all thrown into the basement, and when you walk near those suits, you get a radiation reading of, I think it was 10,000 times or 100,000 times above background radiation. If you drove there for more than an hour, at the distance he was standing away from those suits, you would get a lifetime exposure. And as bad as that is, he found something that is about 100 times worse. And bear in mind that when it comes to exposure to nuclear energy, there were 3 factors that determined the amount of exposure you got. How strong is the source? out that cigarette smoke contains a small amount of radioactive polonium and lead. Very small amount. It's only a little bit above background radiation, but it is slightly radioactive. But when those particles are deposited on your lung, one cell away from your lung, and some of them go into the bloodstream, they're inside of the red corpuscles. The bottom line of that is it is 100 times higher in radiation dosage than if you were in that cellar in Chernobyl, and it's there for 10 years. So now, cigarette smoking creates an awful lot of medical problems for people, like Leonard Nimoy, for instance. Let me drop. And when you burn cigarette smoke, they've recognized close to 1,000 chemicals that are generated, and many of them are toxic and carcinogenic. So is cigarette smoke creating all of the damage because of nuclear radiation, because of chemistry, and because of toxic chemicals? Yes, it's the wicked combination of all of the above. And so people who are smoking really have to give it up. It is the most destructive thing I know of that used to be socially acceptable. And as we get more and more of the details, we're finding out that it's pretty bad. Now, when it comes to going to Mars, let me drop this. There were a group of very far-thinking people that are members of the Astronomical Society of Long Island about 3 or 4 years ago. On their listserv, where they're sending emails back and forth to each other, somebody got on the subject of going to Mars with a good telescope. And I started giving some of my details of what I've just given you guys tonight. My goodness, were people mad at me. Wow. I was giving a series of messages on their email system on this subject. And I became a persona non grata. They cut me off to make sure that they wouldn't hear any more of those messages. They couldn't tolerate that. How in the world, Dick, could you be so negative? Don't you realize that we're going to make breakthroughs in all of these areas and all these problems are going to go away? I said, okay. You can believe that if you want. So, this is a very nice lady from Duke University, a senior, very high-performance lady, who out of 202,000 people is now down to the 100, and she's the only candidate from New York State. She's a... very enthusiastic about this, but my goodness, there's a lot of steps between here and there. I don't think it's going to happen. And of the guys that are hearing me tonight, you haven't developed anywhere near as much anger that I can hear compared to the Asley people. And so a man's got to know his limitations, as Clint Eastwood would say. Let me drop. And to think I'm going to fly by flapping my hands, or to think that I can wish my way to a life on Mars and live glamorously in the sunlight and the pure temperatures of Mars. My goodness. It gets so extremely cold by Antarctic standards. It's got an atmosphere that's essentially not there. You need water and it's very scarce. You need air and it almost doesn't exist. And you need protection from all that radiation. And you need a hell of a lot of food to support a human being 24/7. You need an amount of food that's creating 130 joules per second of energy has to be poured into that human being in order to sustain life. Where's all that going to come from? It's not easy. So if you don't admit the limitations up front and start working on the limitations, by my standards, you're very naive and you're a dreamer. And so I believe these people are sincere, but my goodness, they've got a long way to go in educating themselves. If they would just read this book by Mary Roach, Packing for Mars, and you read some of the details of what really happens behind the scenes at NASA, well-written book, not written to be negative, and it hasn't been, let me drop. The book hasn't been banned by NASA. I mean, she's got a lot of contacts there who have whispered in her ear as to what it's really like. And she quotes them. Says where the information came from. So if you don't like her information, well, then you don't like her sources. And she's got a lot of sources. Any further discussion on all of this happy thought tonight, give me a call letters right now. KQLIW.
I have a different kind of question to talk to you.
Dick, WS2N. I did read that book, Dick. I think I mentioned that in the past. Excellent. Just what you said. it's not by, she's did a lot of research and a lot of contacts within the astronaut community.
Yeah, Wes wants to open up a new subject. Paul just gave me a quick discussion, and there was another person besides Paul. Who was the other person?
Joe, why? I have a question directly for you related to this subject.
Fire away, Joe.
Saying that they put all this collection of hardware together, take this group of human beings and actually propel them to Mars, and they actually get there, will you have the means to listen to them?
I'm not quite sure what you mean by the word you. You could mean NASA with the Deep Space Network in Goldstone, California, the 240-foot dish, or do you mean me, Dick Nadel, K2RIW in his backyard? Right now, no. I mean, yes, I've listened to the astronauts, the Apollo astronauts, on the moon, a quarter of a million miles away. Am I going to be able to hear somebody 300 million miles away? Not a chance with my current hardware at any reasonable length of communication rate. I mean, in the case of the Voyager spacecraft, 12 billion miles away, three times the distance to Pluto, as long as you send the information slow enough, and it's around 50 bits per second, with a very carefully aimed X-band dish on Voyager, talking to a very carefully aimed 240-foot dish in Goldstone, California, with a state-of-the-art low-noise Mesa front-end receiver. Let me drop it. Under those conditions, at a very low data rate, you can talk. Now, could I, with the best hardware I can develop, would I be able to hear the weak carrier from a transmission from Mars by using WSJT techniques, where it gives me a display that shows that, yes, there is a carrier there 24 dB below the noise? Could I do that? Possibly, but I'm not going to get voice out of that. You think you're going to make a phone call from Mars and then talk to all of your friends on a cell phone across the United States? Not so easy. So maybe that's sort of what you're asking, Joe. To be 2RYY, K2RIW.
That's exactly what I was asking. You did once before, and I'm sure this would provide one hell of a challenge for you. But you don't think with the apparatus you have, it's just you're going to be able to do that. You just don't have the property to put up a 240-foot dish.
Oh, I've dreamed about such things, Joe. Then I came back to reality. The good news, with a quarter of a million miles to the moon, I was able to hear astronaut audio when they were on their high-gain dish antenna. I heard astronaut audio from the lunar module and the command module going around the moon. And I also heard the carrier from the ALSA packages, Apollo Lunar Surface Experimental Packages. I heard those carriers. And so, as I said, on their high-gain antenna, I heard astronaut audio. And I heard some things that a little bit exciting to listen to, because I'm hearing quasi-private communication between them and Houston during the time they're not connected to the network, so they weren't being super careful with their conversation and what they're saying. So, good stuff to listen to, exciting for me, and a good challenge. But that's only a quarter of a million miles. The closest you get to Mars and Earth is 36 billion miles, not a quarter of a million. That's, a few hundred times more difficult. And that's only when you're at opposition. There are times when you're not 36 million miles, but you're 336 million miles. The real spacing between Earth and Mars at the time of landing will almost be on the opposite side of the sun, because that's the minimum energy orbit you have to use to get there. So, wow. There's a darn many things. I mean, right after the Apollo mission, I guess... I think it was President Ford, or was it Johnson? Johnson. Okay, now let's go to Mars. And easy to say those words. When Kennedy said he's going to the moon, he had a whole lot of very smart people backing him up, and even those smart people had a huge amount of naivete until they discovered Lunar Orbit Rendezvous. The Saturn V rocket was probably 5 or 10 to 1 too small to bring an astronaut to the moon by what we thought was the way at that time. Good job. Let me think now. What was the name of that very first moon landing sci-fi movie of around 1952? It was the movie just before Rocket Ship XM. Anybody remember the name of that movie? It's before your times. Anyhow, everybody used to believe you build a great big rocket, you go to the moon, and back it down. Well, you're taking a huge amount of hardware and bringing it down to that gravity well called moon, and then you got to bring it back out of that gravity well. Lunar orbit rendezvous is such where you realize that only a small percentage of your hardware has to go down to the moon. And the majority of it stays up in orbit around the moon and gives you a huge energy advantage, 5 to 1 or 10 to 1 energy advantage. Can you imagine trying to design a rocket 5 or 10 times bigger than Saturn V in order to do it by the conventional way? So Kennedy made his pronouncement. It was a couple of years downrange when some very smart engineer at Grumman, I think it was at Grumman, invented the concept of lunar orbit rendezvous. You probably have more of the details of that one, Paul. I think it was a Grumman engineer, but they are not absolutely positive. WS2N, K2LIW.
I'm trying to think of his name. Hang on with an H. I can't remember his name. Yeah, I think he was, but he tried to sell them on it, and they didn't buy it the first time, and then he went at it, and then somebody else said, wait, what about this guy that was talking about this way to dock around the moon? And somebody else, you know, remembered what he said, and then they went back to him, and that's how that all got started. I can't think of, I'm trying to think of the name of the movie you're thinking about, but I know Von Braun wanted to take 2 Saturn V's, and he was going to, you know, dock in orbit and then bring this big heavy spacecraft to the moon and kind of do what you said before, but, you know, vertical landing, vertical takeoff type of thing. That never happened. This guy won out by a mile. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I think the movie was called
AC2IS,
recognized. I think the movie is called Destination Moon, around roughly 1951. Nice color movie. The spacesuits were ridiculous. It was every, overly obvious. You're looking at a great big hole in the front, if you know what I mean, where the space, where the mass should be. And these were obviously inflated pieces of a balloon-like plastic as a spacesuit. But everyone believed at that time. And also, let's see, Wernher von Braun's books, Willie Lee's books, all of these books, rocket ships, rocket spaceships, and rocket something in spaceships, were a couple of very famous books. Collier magazine had a whole lot of pictures on this stuff in the late 60s. Late 50s. And so it was a long time before they stopped having the rocket go to the moon and simply back down. Now, Bill, do you know of a solution as an easy way to get there in less than a year with all of the food and air and the water that you need in some kind of a reproducible manner? AC2IS, K2LIW, you got it, Bill.
I'm not sure why that question came to me, but I'm not sure if you heard before I mentioned the name John C. I'm not sure how to pronounce the last name, Humboldt or Humboldt. Was the lunar orbit rendezvous guy, and my understanding is that his championing of lunar orbit rendezvous had negative consequences for his career, I believe, which was at NASA, AC2IS.
I think you're right, Bill, and Paul is also right that the first 2-3 times he presented this, people said you're crazy. Why go through all of this complication of building a spacecraft that comes apart and a portion of it goes down and a portion of it you leave and only a little bit of that comes back and you re-dock it and then put it all back together and then fly back home? And why go through all that complication? And the answer is you save either 5 to 1 or 10 to 1 on the original launch capability. Can you imagine building a Saturn V, which had, I think it was a something like 6.5 million pounds of thrust. Can you imagine building something 5 or 10 times bigger because you don't want to use lunar orbit rendezvous, which, yes, is a complicated maneuver. And when you come back up from the moon, if you don't do it at exactly the right time, with exactly the right thrust, in exactly the right azimuth and elevation direction, you get co-elliptic orbits and co-planar orbits, and then really dock before burning up a whole lot of fuel. As we soon as
turn them down, Dick, they didn't like that docking at the coming off the moon.
Yeah, Dick, another question.
An extremely dangerous procedure. And as we found out in the Gemini mission, the first couple of Gemini missions in which we tried to do docking in space, and it was unsuccessful, burned up all the docking fuel and didn't make it, because there's a very complicated chunk of mathematics you have to solve before you can do docking. Wes, is your question on space, because that's really the subject right now. WS2N, I mean, N2XJN, K2LAW.
That is enough.
So, lunar orbit rendezvous, because of its, let me pick a number, 3-5 times more complication and a lot more danger. I can see how they would be resisting it. But when it saves you 5-1 or 10-1 in launch capability, you either do that or you don't go to the moon. I mean, Kennedy made his pronouncement. Everyone believes it at the time. At the time he made the pronouncement, he thought he had the capability. He didn't. They were off by a decimal point, if you know what I mean, on whether or not they could do it. And some number of years downrange, they discovered a way. And boy, did I make myself unpopular with the Astronomical Society of Long Island by bringing some of these negative-sounding details. I'm not trying to be negative. As Clint Eastwood says, I've said so often, man's got to know his limitations. You got to know where the minefield is if you want to survive. Okay, hit us with your antenna question, Wes. N2XJN.
You had Rich feeding in the wings, too, Dick.
Rich. Okay, which Rich? Give me that call letters again.
N2EO. You said you were going to take him after the space report. And I think you had another one. I think there was two.
Yeah, AC2IS had another question, and Rich had a question. I guess we better take them in order. N2EO, go ahead with your question, Rich. K2LAW. Okay, maybe Rich went to sleep. Bill, you did ask earlier for another question. AC2IS, K2LAW, go ahead, Bill.
Yes, back at the time, the topic was Radio Shack, and one question is, I wonder if there are any still open and having those big sales. The ones by me, the ones I've seen are all closed already. The question I wanted to ask was, if it's a foregone conclusion that my house is going to have LED lighting, and I presume that this LED lighting is going to create a lot of RF noise, is there a good way or a recommended way to shield those LED lights so that it does not impact radio reception in the house so much? AC2IS.
First of all, the radio figure have earnest.
I've got a guess as to what's going on there, Bill. The light-emitting diodes themselves do not make radio noise. It's the power supply, the constant current power supply, the switching power supply they conventionally use. Light-emitting diodes, you've got a couple of volts going across each one. You've got a raw source of power of 120 volts, you say, and you want to cut the 120 volts down to, let me pick a number, 2 volts to run the light-emitting diode. And at first you'd say, well, I just make a 2-volt power supply, a switching power supply. Well, the actual voltage drop across each individual light-emitting diode is a function of its temperature. And so with a very small change in voltage, you can easily put too much current and blow it out and give it a very short life, or too little current and it gives you very little light. So they end up making a constant current power supply. So they put some number of them in series, feed them with a constant current power supply. Let me drop. And the easiest way to make a constant current power supply is with a switching regulator. Depending on how you design the switching regulator, you can make interference up the kazoo. I know that, let me think now. Why can't I think of his name? The guy who lives in Hempstead. The guy who runs our tune-up clinics. Andy, WA2CDL. What's Andy's call letters?
WA2CDL.
WA2CDL. And he had, I believe it was light-emitting diodes in his shack, mounted across the ceiling. And whenever he turned them on, he saw a lot of radio noise. He found a solution to it. There was a way of quieting down that switching regulator, the constant current switching regulator. So it's not the diodes themselves. It's an extremely cheaply designed switching regulator, constant current power supply that's feeding them. So you buy the right brand name or buy the wrong brand name, but willing to make electromagnetic interference modifications, I'm reasonably sure you can make the problem go away. Here we go. Bill, man does not have to live with electromagnetic interference. We have the ability to filter those signals away, move them to another frequency, and stop them from being emitted in the first place.
I got a comment at 2MB.
Your 110-volt wiring becomes a beautiful antenna for that system if you didn't design it correctly. So, have you used light-emitting diodes, Barry, and have you found a solution to it in 2MB, K2RIW?
I think that was made WS when I have them with no noise.
So, did you ever have noise that you eliminate the noise? Paul first, and then we're going to go over to Barry, because you both answered. Paul, did yours ever make noise and you changed them, or you just bought the right brand name and it doesn't make noise? Over to you, Paul.
Over to solid-state lighting, and they are. The noise is going away in this area, so evidently you're doing okay with those things.
Basis DPC.
Okay, we got Paul and then Hal in that order. Go ahead, Paul.
I'm looking at one right now. I have them in the shack. I got them outside. I got them all over everywhere. No noise. And the ones I bought a company name. Is it or is it FIET? I don't know. Dyslexia. Yeah. But very good. I got them from Ace Hardware. No problem. I didn't even think about it. I know the CFLs were a problem years ago, but not these.
H-U-R-A-W on the net?
Not really, Dick. I've used light-emitting diodes. I never really experienced a noise problem with them. So I can't really give you, an honest answer on that. And Barry, if you want to swing over on HF, I'm tuned and ready to go.
Not tonight. It wasn't late and I'm tired. But tomorrow.
All right. So that's my answer on that, Dick. Go ahead.
Light them because there's no heat. You can put your tongue on this thing, it won't bother you.
Yes, the worst is those sodium vapors. My God, do they make noise.
Yeah, now in the case of a plasma inside of a fluorescent-like tube, now you've got a very broadband noise generator, RFYs. You've got all the mechanism there. I mean, the plasma you put inside of a neon tube, makes a very specific amount of noise. In fact, the very early noise sources for an automatic noise figure indicator literally consisted of a neon tube at a slanted, let me pick a number, 20-degree angle, slanted across the middle of a piece of waveguide. And so you powered that up, it made a very calculatable amount of waveguide, microwave noise that could easily be calibrated, and that became the standard noise source for automatic noise figure indicators. So a plasma is a beautiful negative resistance material that can make all kinds of radio noise. So, Bill, you asked the original question, how do you kill the noise of light-emitting diodes? What made you think they are so noisy? Did you buy brand X and didn't check ahead of time, and you ran into a problem, Bill? AC2IS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is AC2IS, and yes, I have an LED-based incandescent light bulb replacement, and whatever is going on there, if my radio is within, say, 2 yards, it's very noticeable. It's been trying to listen to, say, the station, this repeater, AC2IS.
I wonder if Bill could tell us the manufacturer of that bulb so that we could all avoid it.
Yeah, I've got two questions for you. Barry's question, what brand name, what model number, so we don't buy it. And maybe we'll find out from Andy of A2CDL what brand name he bought it first before he either switched around the brand or modified it. And the nicest of all things, Bill, would be if you could have access to either a a do-it-yourself spectrum analyzer, or really borrow one, borrow somebody's service monitor that has a spectrum analyzer function, maybe even Andy's CDL that's on loan to you for a short period of time, or one or two other people. So if you put some kind of a spectrum analyzer with an antenna near your light-emitting diodes, it would be awful nice to look at the real spectrum. For all we know, that the switching regulator is running at 100 kilohertz and making a very spiky square wave at 100 kilohertz, where by the time you listen to the 10,000th harmonic, it's still 10 dB above threshold when you want to listen to a 2-meter repeater. I mean, Andy did, in his work in the New York City subways, discovered that the switching regulator that's used for the fluorescent lighting in the subway makes some pretty potent radio noise. And there's a whole investigation he did of that. So it'd be nice if you could find out what are the real frequencies. I think you're going to find a comb generator. In other words, you're going to find a whole lot of individual spikes with exactly the same spacing across the spectrum. And what brand name and model number? ACQIS, K2LIW. Go ahead, Bill.
This is ACQIS. Yeah, I just sort of ran and bulb. You see some markings on it, but I do not see a brand name. And I would assume that these things are going through so many changes that you would not find this exact bulb anywhere on the market right now anyway. But I do recall when these were just coming out, people warning that there were RFI issues with them. Did experience those issues. ACQIS.
Okay, when you come back to us, Bill, get a little closer to the mic, shout a little bit louder. That particular radio you're using is quite low on audio. Also, if the manufacturer of that bulb is so unproud of his product that he doesn't have his brand name and model number stamped on the side of it, if he's keeping it a secret, my next question is, where did you buy it? I don't think you would buy it at a garage sale. I'm guessing you went to Lowe's or Home Depot or someplace like that. So where did you buy that bulb, Bill, and roughly how expensive was it? ACQIS, K2LIW?
This is ACQIS. My recollection is that the bulb was pretty expensive at the time. There were not too many of these things around. I'm guessing this was a $68 bulb. I believe it was from a Lowe's or a Home Depot. I don't remember exactly where. And I do see a UL listing and a bunch of numbers, but I do not see a brand name. ACQIS.
Quick comment, Dick.
Yeah, John recognized. I'm going to get you in a second. When you listen to 2 meters, it's giving you interference. Have you seen interference anywhere else? Television, FM radio? Have any other radios in your house given you interference other than 147.375? Over to you, Bill.
Yeah, can Bill explain the shape of that bulb so we might recognize it if we saw it in a store?
You've got it, Bill.
One question for the shape of the bulb. So it's sort of vaguely light bulb shaped, although the majority of the bulb is a heat sink. And there's a little diffuser area on top. Looks like a little sort of muffin top kind of thing on, sitting on top of a big heat sink. You put them all together and it's vaguely the outline of a bulb, but not quite the right shape. But I said, what was the other question again?
Okay, you've given us some words, but you didn't draw a picture. Is it the shape of an ordinary old-fashioned incandescent bulb, or is it that triangular shape of the of a kind of a light bulb that people use for external lighting? Over to you, Bill. That was question number one. And did you see interference at any other frequency other than 147.375? Over to you, Bill.
I did not notice interference on anything else, but I mean, it's cable TV here, so it's not over the air. I don't spend a lot of time listening to FM, terrestrial broadcasts, so I don't think there's interference there, but I'm not quite sure. And this is vaguely the shape of an incandescent, standard incandescent bulb. The heat sink is sort of vaguely that shape, and then there's a sort of a little mushroomy muffin top thing sitting on top of that. So, yeah, vaguely incandescent bulb shape, D2IS.
And now, how many watts is it supposed to be representative of, and does it get very warm?
D2IS, my recollection was that this is a 60 watt equivalent, and I didn't turn it on just now, but judging by the size of the heatsink here, I would say that it must be blowing off some heat. D2IS.
Bill, are you speaking close to the mic and speaking louder? Your audio is still quite low.
Mic is very close. Not sure why there would be low audio. This is a big change from when I was first transmitting AC2IS.
There's a slim possibility that the gain between the eastern repeater and the western repeater is low, but you're a healthy 6 dB down in audio from my point of view. Let's see if Barry sees it that way. And so it's supposedly 60 watt equivalent. Do they say how many watts it's really consuming, Bill, AC2IS, K2LAW?
I found an anomaly in that, to how many watts they consume, to how many watts they put out. And I found in a couple of cases, the fluorescents actually consume less power for the amount of light than these LEDs do. You gotta be real careful with that.
Interesting. Let's see what Bill's got to say on that.
Again, this is going by transits and memory here, but yes, it consumes significantly less than the 60 watts. You know, the 60 watts is an equivalent amount of light compared to a 60 watt. I would guess that this is 80 watts or lower. AC2IS.
So most likely the heat sink that's on it is dissipating most of 20 watts. Would you see it that way, Bill?
Yeah, that's what I would think. AC2IS.
And by the amount of heat that you feel when you touch that heatsink and the size that it's got, does your gut feel say that it's in the vicinity of 20 watts of real thermal dissipation? Over to you, Bill.
Well, I just unscrewed it. I haven't gotten near it while it's been on in a long time, so I really don't know. Don't have a direct measurement of the amount of heat it's throwing off AC2IS.
Dick, I'm thinking if you put an ammeter in series with that bulb, you could actually see how much amps that stupid thing is drawing at how many volts. You might find that the fluorescents, the screw-in fluorescents, actually consume less power.
Yeah, if that's true, Barry, then they've done a great job of advertising and convincing us the other way around. We are being led to believe that light-emitting diodes are more efficient. There is a catch, though. When it comes to making an extremely inexpensive constant current switching regulator, there's all kinds of ways where you can make a switching regulator that puts out 20 watts of current to the light-emitting diodes and dissipates 10 watts in its power supply. Whereas, you know, the power supply could be running a 60% efficiency, whereas a very good high-quality switching regulator might run 90 or 95%. So part of that could be performance versus dollars. And you had a drop out when you told us how many dollars this 60-watt equivalent bulb was. So tell us the dollars of it again when you bought it, Bill. And is the altitude of it approximately the altitude of a 60-watt incandescent bulb? If I had a fixture that had a height limitation and I could squeeze a 60-watt incandescent light bulb into the fixture, is this thing a little bit taller than that? So tallness and real dollars. AC2IS, give us plenty of audio. K2LAW.
This is AC2IS. This particular bulb is about the height of a regular incandescent bulb. I have noticed that some other LED incandescent bulb replacements are a little bit taller. Also, this one seems to throw most of its light away from the light socket, not so much out to the side, so that may limit where you would want to use this particular light bulb. And then dollar figure question, my recollection is that way back when I bought this, it was going for about $80, maybe $60. It was pretty expensive for a light bulb, E2IS.
Wow, $60
to $80, whereas I imagine a 60-watt incandescent bulb is a little bit more in the $2 category, I think, although I could be wrong. And so $2 versus $60, are they claiming that the life is 30 times longer and the energy consumption is so much lower that after 2 years you come out ahead? Is there any claim of life or when is the crossover of a payback, if you know what I mean, if you happen to know, Bill? I know this is getting a little bit complicated. AC2IS, K2RIW.
AC2IS. Again, going by distant memories here, but there were claims on the package of, you know, ridiculous lifespan of the light bulb compared to a regular incandescent. I don't think they bothered with the return on investment calculation because I believe that waiting a long time to get a return on this particular bulb. AC2IS.
Yeah, there was a similar problem with compact fluorescent lights. Ridiculous light, life expectancies. However, many people, and I'm one of them, have run into troubles where the bulb is in good shape, but the power supply died way before it was supposed to. And so, and also I noticed that compact fluorescent bulbs put out a fairly different spectrum compared to incandescents or compared to real lighting. Yes, I've got old eyes, but when my wife underlines things that I'm supposed to make special note of in the newspaper, and she underlines it with her yellow marker pen, under compact fluorescent lighting, I do not see the yellow. It isn't there. She sees it, I don't see it. I walk outside where I get good sunlight, and there's the bright yellow showing up real nice. So I know that there's spectral lines of emission and great big gaps, so to speak, in the compact fluorescent lights. Whether or not light-emitting diodes also have that is an interesting question. Wes, you had an antenna question. In 2XJN, K2LAW, go ahead, Wes.
We have only 2 minutes left, so you have two antennas in space in 1 mile apart. Both of the antennas are omnidirectional, and both of them have the same polarization. What percentage of the power from the transmitting antenna would be received by receiving antenna?
Okay, if it's truly a free space path and there isn't any reflection from the ground and other objects and there isn't absorption of trees, if it really is a free space, the exact number of decibels of insertion loss is a very nice formula. You're going to want to write this one down. The real antenna engineers use it every day. Insertion loss in decibels equals 36.6 plus 20 log F plus 20 log D. I'll repeat that. Insertion loss between the antennas in decibels of loss equals 36.6 plus 20 log F, foxtrot, plus 20 log D. F is frequency in megahertz. D is distance in miles. Plug in the frequency in megahertz, the distance in miles, and you solve that equation, and you know exactly how many decibels of loss. For instance, let me drop. I don't know the exact number, but if you did that for 146 megahertz, isotropic antenna to isotropic antenna, 146 megahertz, and you plug in the numbers, you're going to find something close to 90 decibels of loss in the first mile. So you put in a plus 90 dBm signal into one antenna, and a mile away you receive a 0 dBm signal, 90 decibels of loss. And maybe it's 87, but it's in that neighborhood. you need to fill on that, Wes, in 2XJN. It's a very handy formula. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Unfortunately, I don't have anything to write down, but if you have a time to just write it down, send it to me or next time. Now, question to you. You have those two antennas, and now those two antennas are 10 miles apart. What would be the difference between 1 mile apart and 10 miles apart?
Exactly 20 decibels. 20 decibels more loss, 10 miles apart instead of 1 mile apart, by that formula. Over to you.
Okay. So, we would say that antenna is a sending signal omnidirectionally. In the mean of path, you're getting a certain percentage. You can set it in watts, you can set it in decibels. So let's say, if you were to say it in watts, you're putting 100 watts from the transmitting antenna. You have 1 mile apart by 90 dBs. Then that would be how many watts, and by 20 miles further, how many watts on the receiving antenna?
A 20 dB of extra loss for 10 miles of means that whatever you had, 1% of it, 1% instead of 100%, the extra 20 miles. Bye-bye, you all.
Thank you very much, Dave. It was actually...
Bye-bye for now.
That is over. The repeater looks like it's out of repeat. Probably you went to sleep for the night.
All right, copy.
The TechNet's already signed off about 10 minutes ago.
Horse Mounted Mobile, K2LIW. How copy, Charlie?
Yeah, how you doing, Dick? No, I realize the TechNet signed off. Thank you, come back. Dick, I just sent you, an email a few minutes ago when you were discussing the thing about the EMI from last year. A few articles from the USC a while ago. I think it was last year sometime.
Yeah, I got that email from you, Charlie, and I thank you. Amazing. I can change my power output of this rig, and the signal to noise ratio in the repeater doesn't change. Wow. In the past, I had trouble getting enough signal into this repeater. So, how many countries are you up to these days, Charlie? Horse Mounted Mobile, K2RAW.
Well, let me put it here this way. 300, one engines. Eight of that three.
Wow. That is quite an investment in time. And how much of that was done with wire antennas? How much of that was done with more exotic antennas, Charlie?
Honestly, I couldn't tell you. I'd have to back through my blog and check out the note when I could have been there. Say that a good percentage of it was from wire antennas. Maybe the first 100 or something. Well, wires. So my whole ham career, which actually comes down to...
Well, of all of those that you got lacking the heat, how many of those entities no longer exist, or how many of those entities was some guy visiting a rock in the Pacific somewhere and is really, really no inhabitants there? Over to you, Charlie.
Well, that I really can't say. Do need. I'm looking at my sheet and I can't hear.